Yes, ladies and gentlemen, that is the shofar signaling the beginning of the Jewish New Year, and as such, I am on vacation today.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, September 29th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape as I am spending the holiday with my family. Ladies and gentlemen, for today's program, we have an interview that I did with Professor William Lozonik. Bill Lozonik, he's from the Center for Industrial Competitiveness at the UMass Lowell. This interview, I've interviewed him in the past. He really outlines the whole genesis of this notion of corporations taking profits overseas and basically not paying any taxes on them here. And how this policy was designed, when, why, and how it is seriously hurting job creation in this country. And then, following the Bill Lozonik interview, it's an interview I did down at Occupy Wall Street with a defense attorney who has been representing protesters down there and helping out, doing this work pro bono. Very interesting. Pardon the audio quality. We had a little bit of problem with the audio down there, so it's a little bit tough to hear, but definitely worth taking a listen to. And, of course, for those members, you get a special bonus 30-minute interview I did with Bobby Kennedy for Ring of Fire Radio. Of course, he's my co-host there, talking about the death penalty and talking specifically about his experience with the death penalty. Both from the perspective of being a family member of a victim, of course, his father, Robert Kennedy Jr., Robert Kennedy Sr., was assassinated, and his family's response to that, and as a family member of two people who were convicted of murder. It's a fascinating interview. I know you're going to enjoy it. And if, folks, you haven't become a member, you can become a member now at majority.fm and go back and listen to the full podcast that's available for members only. And listen, this is also the last day you can go to podcastawards.com and nominate the Majority Report for Best Political and News Podcast. You go to the podcastawards.com. Look down the page in the left column down towards the end. You will see where you can nominate the show for Best Political and News Show. I need your help, folks. This is the way to spread the word. If we just get a nomination, then people see us as one of five podcasts they should listen to if they're interested in politics and news. You must do some work to get the word out there, particularly if you're one of those freebie people. Anyways, here's the interview. Happy New Year, L'Shana Tova, as we say, for those of us who know the Hebrew words, but not really what they mean. And I will be back tomorrow, Friday, with a live show with all your favorites. Cliff Schechter, that other guy who ostensibly gives us film reviews, even though he's not a film reviewer. I just found that out. I didn't know. And we shall see. So thanks for joining us. Enjoy. See you tomorrow. So, Bill, let's walk us through. I want you to walk us through the history of this capacity for corporations to defer their repatriation of foreign profits. But before we do, before we dive into this, because I think this is a very important topic, and frankly, I think it's going to be part of the super committee's deal that will come out in a couple of months. But before we do, when a corporation, an American corporation, does business overseas, do they get taxed on those profits overseas and then are subject to a double tax, as they claim over here?
No, they get taxed overseas, but they would get a tax credit if they brought the money back, just like an individual would. I mean, that's the exact same for individuals. The tax rates for corporations overseas tend to be lower than the 35% tax rate in the United States. There's various reasons for that. It's well known that Ireland, for example, has a low tax rate within the European Union to attract foreign direct investment, to attract multinationals there. But the fact is that whatever the tax rate is there, if they were to repatriate the profits and pay the going corporate tax rate in the United States, they get a credit for whatever they paid abroad.
So not only do their profits are not taxed twice, they get a tax credit, as you say. Yeah. In some respects, one could argue that we are in fact subsidizing their profit making overseas, because we're saying that you can make that and not pay any other taxes. I mean, in other words, this is a cost of business for them to do to do their operations overseas, but we actually give them a tax break for doing it.
Yeah, and of course the question is, why would you do that? When you look back at the history of this law, I went through and I traced, what was the impetus to this. In the late 50s, for a variety of reasons, U.S. companies, the United States, was concerned about U.S. presence abroad, of course. There was a lot of pressure to expand U.S. presence abroad. There was even, at the time, it was said that they had to do this in order to compete with the Soviet Union abroad, which was a bit of a joke, a big joke, actually, because although you could say we compete with China abroad, we could even compete with Malaysia abroad. No, we still don't compete with Russia abroad. I mean, the Soviet Union did not have any multinationals that were challenging the United States in other countries. Eisenhower, he said he favored it, because it would help what they call poor countries at the time, less developed countries. There could have been something to that, because at the time, most foreign direct investment was not going to less developed countries. And certainly not of the type that you have going there now. It wasn't for manufacturing. It might have been for resource extraction, mines, copper mines, nickel mines, bananas, whatever, but it wasn't going for manufacturing at that time. And you could say, okay, let's try to promote investment in less developed countries. But whatever the reasons, the law was passed right at the end of the Eisenhower administration, and then immediately when Kennedy became president, they tried to get rid of it, and there were a number of attempts to do this. They didn't succeed. And over the course of time, really as long as organized labor was strong, the Democrats were going after this law, because organized labor was against it.
Now, we should say the law itself essentially says that you can defer paying taxes on these profits until you bring this money back. So it basically encouraged these corporations to keep their profits offshore, essentially, to defer taxes. And tax deferral is a big strategy for accountants, isn't it?
Yeah. So it did two things. First, it encouraged them to go abroad in the first place, because they could make the profits there without paying taxes, but then to constantly reinvest the profits and keep the profits abroad. And so that basically then just remained on the books over time, and every once in a while there was some movement to get rid of it, and really became an issue, much more of an issue, after 2003 and in the 2004 election campaigns, because you know in 2003 offshoring had become a big issue. And by this time, really, the nature of the problem was much different than it had been in the late 50s. Now, and this really had started in the late 60s, corporations were going to less developed countries and doing manufacturing there. It really started with semiconductor assembling and testing in the late 60s. It's virtually every American semiconductor company was in Asia by 1970. Malaysia, for example, whole development strategy was quite successful, has been quite successful on the basis of foreign direct investment in electronic manufacturing. U.S. companies like HP and Intel that went there, and when they opened up their free trade zone in 1972 are still there. And now, of course, it's a much bigger issue because you have China, India, and so a lot of money is being made abroad, and a lot of money is going abroad, a lot of money is being made abroad. And that's the other thing that's going on now. Huge, huge profits are being made, particularly in China. I wrote something on the auto industry. I mean, it's just amazing, the number of cars being sold into China. And General Motors would be out of business now if it hadn't expanded its output into the Chinese car market. It wouldn't have come out of bankruptcy, in my view. And the huge profits are being made there. And those, the United States is not going to do very well unless those profits are brought back. And basically, at this point, corporations, in my view, are holding the United States, U.S. corporations are holding U.S. people hostage by saying, that's our money, it's abroad, we're going to keep it there, and unless you get rid of, now they don't even call it a tax break, they call it a tax penalty.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about your piece, is that, you know, you discuss back in 61 and 63, President Kennedy tried to repeal this law that gave a favorable tax advantage to these corporations. In 76, there was an attempt to overturn the law, because, again, this is essentially a tax break, the fact that you don't have to repatriate, that until you explicitly repatriate this money, it's not subject to tax. These were close votes. And like you say, this started out as a tax break, which has somehow morphed into a tax penalty. Let's talk about the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004. It was one of those very well-named but not so well-meaning laws that the Bush administration was famous for. Tell us what it did and what it was supposed to do.
Okay, well, it was supposed to create, you know, get companies to invest in the United States in real assets, create jobs, and by repatriating the profits. So it said that they could have, in one fiscal year, a tax holiday. It actually was 5.25%, I believe, that they had to pay, but it was substantially lower than the 35%. Bring the money back in that 1 year, and you'll get this break. And but you have to invest in jobs, basically, in plant and equipment jobs, something that is real. It explicitly said that you could not bring the money back and spend it, give it out to shareholders, increase dividends, stock buybacks in particular. So that was in the language of the law. So someone thought about this and said, hey, you know, and I should say that this was a time, as I've written about quite extensively, when both dividends and buybacks were going up. Of course, part of it is related to the tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts, which cut, you know, taxes on dividends and capital gains to 15%. So now there was this, you know, let's bring the profits back tax-free. Let's give them out to shareholders and in the form of capital gains or dividends, and then they're only taxed 15% now because of the Bush tax cut. So there's a whole package here. But nevertheless, even in the language of the bill, you weren't supposed to be able to spend that money on distributions to shareholders. So some studies, as I quote, there's been a few studies that have been done of this that show that, in fact, if you look at the 30, it went from about 60, I think 62 billion on average per year had been repatriated by corporations the previous few years, and then it went up to 300 billion, so quite a big increase in profits coming back. But a huge proportion, practically all of it, when you add it up, went to stock buybacks and dividends, particularly stock buybacks. Now, I mean, it's associated with it because the companies brought the money back and increased their expenditures on dividends and buybacks. Of course, they then said, no, well, that wasn't from the money we brought back. That was from the money the profits we already had here. And in fact, you can do buybacks. You don't even need to do them on profits. You can pay dividends even if you're taking losses. So the point is that they basically said, no, that's not the money we brought back. And then anything that they might have used that money for here, like expenditures on R&D and plant and equipment training of workers that was permissible under the Act, they said, oh, no, that was the money that we brought from bond. So everything was fungible. You could just play these little games. And so they found that, in fact, this did not have a big impact on jobs or the impact they thought it would have. And it did allow them to use their cash to buy back stock, to increase dividends, which they did. And
we've spoken in the past about why corporations are so interested in buying back stocks and increasing dividends. It's more often than not because the CEO and the board of directors, they have a little cottage industry in the form of their bonuses and compensation that are tied to the behavior of the stock.
Particularly stock options. And that's so they have a big incentive to do this. And what's interesting about the more recent discussion, particularly I quoted that op-ed piece by John Chambers from Cisco Systems and Safra Katz, the president of Oracle, that in which they called this a tax penalty that was being imposed on American business rather than a tax concession. But they don't even make this pretense. They said in the article, they say, let's bring it back. And even if we spend it on stock buybacks, that'll help lift the stock market. And, you know, so it's everything goes now. I mean, they want to bring the money back, don't pay taxes on it or pay minimal taxes on it, and be able to do whatever they want with it. So it'll just become increasingly part of the problem. There actually have been companies with huge amounts of money, Microsoft and Intel, in 2009, for example, borrowed money to do buybacks because they didn't want to bring the money back from abroad. You know, so this way they, of course, you know, they borrowed it at cheap rates. They laid off workers at the same time, by the way. But they get to bring the money back. They rather than invest it abroad, they'll still keep some money to invest abroad, but they'll I think the main impact would be to try to boost their stock price, what I call manipulating the stock price. And what we've seen over the last couple of years, as we've been in this jobless recovery, is everybody saying, where are the jobs? Where are the jobs? That's what corporations in the United States are doing with their money. And I think that ultimately is the thing that I think everybody needs to talk about. I mean, if corporations aren't going to invest in the United States, there's nothing the government can do. It's going to create a prosperous economy.
And let me ask you this. What of their threats that if we can't bring back our offshore profits at essentially a reduced tax rate or no taxes whatsoever, because they're certainly not, we've discussed, they're not getting taxed on this twice because they get the tax credits for anything they pay overseas. What's to stop them from leaving this country? I mean, that's their next threat, right? That we'll just leave this country altogether.
Well, yeah, that's a threat. And, corporations are very viable, powerful, and the way they're governed in this country, they can do that. And so this raises some much deeper issues of, you know, how do these corporations get to be so powerful? It wasn't because of those CEOs who were running them. It was because of often hundreds of thousands of people who built these companies up over decades, gave them the capabilities they have, often huge amount of government investment and subsidy that complemented that, that they were able to make use of, that came from the United States. So part of the problem is this ideology that corporations basically belong to shareholders, which top managers use to basically say they belong, we can do whatever we want with the corporations, because shareholders, in fact, tend to be widely distributed and not actually have much power in the United States. It's the top executives, but they use this as a mantra to basically do whatever they want with the money. And in the end, yeah, they'll leave. And I think I quoted a statement from Steve Ballmer at Microsoft, one of the richest people in the world, one of the most powerful companies in the world, when Barack Obama, when he was president, and I think it was May of 2009, tried to, live up to a campaign promise to get rid of this deferment of taxes. And he immediately responded in the press that, well, if they do this, we're just going to leave. And, you wonder, what goes through this guy's head? This country made him what he is. Now, certainly the guy, the guy has worked hard, has a lot to offer. But, these people are not, who is their allegiance to? Their allegiance is to no one but themselves, it seems to me. And, if you have a country like that, that allows corporations to act that way, you're not going to remain prosperous for very long. Whereas prosperous we are because they weren't always governed in that way in the past.
Do we have, Bill, we just have a minute here, but do we have any leverage? Let's say this company, Microsoft, says, we're going to leave this country. Can we make it more difficult for them to do business in this country? Do we have any leverage whatsoever?
No. I don't think under existing sort of rules of corporate governance, existing notions of who companies are run for, I don't think there's any leverage. I think the kind of the rules of the game need a change, and they need to come into the modern era, where if you don't change the rules of the game, it's not a matter of ideology. It's a matter of is a country like the United States going to be able to remain a prosperous country? And if it seems to me, if you don't change the way corporations act at this point in time, this kind of joblessness and is not going to go away, and it's not even anytime soon. It's going to get over time worse and worse. You might have some booms and busts, but what we've seen, this is the third jobless recovery that we've had since the early 90s, and it's by far the worst. And I see it as a pattern that's not going to be improved until you come to grips with how you get control over the investment behavior, financial behavior of major corporations. We're just too dependent on them. And right now, that discussion isn't even there. So as a result, we don't have any leverage.
Well, Bill, we're going to have to wait to have that discussion as to how we would change those rules to give us some leverage over these major corporations. But thanks for letting us know about this tax repatriation deal, because I think there's every indication this is going to be part of the so-called super committee's ruling on how we raise revenue. And it's really just going to be a sucker's deal for the American public. And I appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Hey, Bill, one question. What would be like the number one rule when you talk about changing the rules of this, what would be the number one initiative we could take that would give us some leverage into making the decision to leave this country? If Microsoft was to say, all right, well, you're going to make us pay taxes, we're going to leave. What would be the number one rule that we could institute, or
The number one rule is it's a fairly big one, but it's one that is not unusual in the global economy, and that is to give some group other than shareholders through the boards of directors, which are really just chosen by management, a say in what corporations do. So that to recognize that, and this goes against the whole notion of private enterprise, and so this is why it's such a you know, it's a very hard sell. But I, you know, I should say that there were top corporate executives right through the 1950s who understood it's really something like stewardship, or, you know, that these corporations are part of a country, and you need to have some, they're trustees of a huge amount of resources. They're not the property of shareholders. I mean, and it seems to me until you get by that and have some notion that there is some obligation of corporations to operate in the interests of the countries that have built them up, you can't take any of the next steps because they're just going to get around it in every way. I mean, it's a fairly fundamental thing, but it's something that is, because well, fundamentals crucial.
Well, when you get a chance to take a look at that that ruling that that the SEC lost, I guess it was in an appellate court.
Yeah, I'll
court,
take a look at it.
Because I'm curious, because if shareholders can't even nominate their own slate of board of directors, I don't know what power they're gonna have. I mean,
yeah, no, and then you know that's. You know, I can tell you one little story. There's a guy at Harvard Business School named Jay Lorsch, who's quite a well-established professor of organizational behavior. And in the late 80s, he sort of, I was around there at that time, and many Harvard Business School professors were concerned about precisely these issues. The other side of it was Michael Jensen, who you probably know him, who was the guru of shareholder value, and he ended up winning out there. But there were some people who were saying, hey, we got to do something. So this guy, Lorsch, who was a tenured guy, very respected at the time, went and wrote a book called Pawns or Potentates, and it was on boards of directors. And it was asking, who really controls them, which was kind of obvious. But anyway, he was asking this question. And the book came out, and then as they usually do, professor has his book come out. They have some of their big donors come. They had him presented in a private meeting. And what I heard from three different people, I wasn't there, is one big donor got up and said, "We don't want Harvard Business School professors writing on this topic."
Wow.
because it's just so obvious the extent to which. These are not, boards, everybody knows this. I mean, it's boards of directors have never been, in any meaningful sense elected by shareholders. They're picked by top managers. And the only thing you can say is that what has changed is the notion that if you don't get the stock price up, maybe the top managers will go. But that's really not coming from shareholders so much as it's coming from these people who are making big bucks on the inside by having all this stock-based compensation and the notion that that's why you run the corporation. And that wasn't an ideology that existed before the 1980s, this notion you run corporations for shareholder value.
Right.
It just wasn't part of the way in which you ran corporations in the United States. You ran them for, there was much more of a trusteeship notion of top management and corporations, and that sort of went by the boards, and that's where we are now. So yeah, trying to go back to it, Dodd-Frank should have dealt with those issues, but I'll look at that and I'll see what I think about it.
All right, well, thanks, Bill. I really appreciate it. Always great to
talk
to you.
Cedar, hi.
Hey, will you grab the mic?
Sure.
What's your name?
My name is Joseph Turco.
And Joseph, tell me what you're doing down here.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm a lawyer. I'm in private practice, and I handle civil rights matters and police misconduct. So people in my line of work, when events like this go down, we try to show up, Since I've been admitted to the bar, it's probably my 12th protest all over the country. I do them pro bono. If I believe in what the folks are doing and if they're engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience, violent protesters, it would be hard for them to convince me to. I believe strongly in Gandhi and Thoreau and Martin Luther King Jr.'s approach to these sorts of things.
All right, so give me a sense of what took place Saturday. I mean, it is now, I think, one of, and for better or for worse, the most probably watched video associated with these protests has been those women getting maced by a supervising cop who's now, at the very least, has been purportedly named in various media outlets. The last I heard is that the New York Police Department said that he used that mace appropriately. Very hard for me, or anybody who's been watching that video, to really believe that's the case. Give me your sense. What happens in that situation? What's going on in the back?
The Paul Brown saying that officer, whose name I'm going to learn later today, I don't know it right now, that was appropriate. That's a question of fact, Sam. Donna Lieberman of the ACLU said it best yesterday, when she said, it was inappropriate, it's unlawful. That's the position of the legal team here, of the National Lawyers Guild, of the ACLU, and of those women victims. If that case proceeds to trial, whether or not it was appropriate would be for a jury to decide, and nobody else.
But what does it take to get that case to trial? Is this going to be a civil proceeding that will be brought by one of those...
Well, ultimately, right. That would be up to those young ladies. But if they decide that they want to proceed as plaintiffs under federal law, Section 1983, police misconduct, they would be free to do that. So there's no question that they have a cause of action. It's up to them if they want to pursue it.
Is there standing for a group in this instance to bring an action by saying that is an intimidation tactic and is infringing upon our First Amendment rights?
I don't see anyone other than those subjected to the police violence. No one else, it seems to me, would have standing. As a group, the group might have standing regarding permitting and so forth.
Yeah, are you aware of the situation that's going on?
I'm actually going to meet with Wiley Steklow in a few minutes, and I'll bring him over here. You want to talk to him. He's also on the legal team and has a lot more data and information than I do. One thing I'll say, though, you mentioned... you asked legally about the police misconduct, but let me tell you this. What the police have done by going over the top is they've radicalized not only the participants, but they've radicalized thousands of onlookers. There are people who didn't care about this protest, who saw the police overreach, and are now sympathetic. So in many ways... I got to be careful how I say it here. But,
well, like I said, you know, that video, for better or for worse, is...
For better or worse, and in the end, this is going to have been for better. They're probably going to back off a little bit.
Now, one of the reports, and you'll bring over this other attorney, but one of the reports has been that they've been asking the owners or the sponsors of this park to allow the protesters to stay here. From your experience as... in being involved in protests like this, what's the theory behind that?
Well, my understanding of this park is that it's not entirely public. Is that your understanding as well?
My understanding is that it's very vague.
Yes, right. When this building to our north...
You're going to talk to the mic.
Yeah, when this building to our north was erected, part of the deal was they had to create this closet. That's common in the city. It's quasi-public, quasi-private. Quite frankly, I don't think that legal issue has been thoroughly worked through.
Right.
But let me get back to you on that.
Okay.
This is a legal action in process.
Now tell me, is there anything you think from your perspective as a lawyer who's down here looking to help these protesters or people should know?
Well, you know, movement law is like something else entirely. It's an entirely different beast. In other words... One of the things that I look to do when there's a mass arrest like there was last week is get down to 100 Center Street, get these people out as fast as I can so that they can get back to the protest. In addition, we also like to use the courtroom process as a furtherance of the action. you know, short of contemptible court theatrics, raising the issues in the proceedings in court is just another extension of the action. And also, in movement law, sometimes the movement's issues trump the individual issues. Some lawyers have problems with that. But so long as your client understands that it's about the bigger issue, and they're willing to make certain legal sacrifices as well.
What does that mean?
Well, because like as a lawyer, your duty is to the zealous representation of your client alone. When you're involved in a movement, however, there's more to it than just that individual client, right? There's the entire movement of which that client is a part of. In my view, as long as that client is willing to go along, look, sometimes, for instance, courtroom theatrics can bite you in the butt, right? So as long as the client is willing to play along, we can continue this protest right into the court.
So if I understand you, there may be an incident where you want to get a client exonerated or to have as little legal implications as possible, but you also have to worry about the precedent that you're setting for other members of the movement. Is that right?
So true. Like, in an average disorderly conduct case, the prosecutor will offer you a plea, you know, take the civil violation, ACD, time served, boom, case over. But when you're in the midst of a protest and you believe you are not guilty, and you believe the police action is wrong, even the most lenient plea bargain is not worth it.
Because you're setting a precedent saying, despite the fact that I won't get the punishment, I am guilty, and essentially saying what we were doing is wrong, as opposed to what we were doing is right.
Well, or what we're doing is right, and what you're doing is wrong, and I won't take any plea that you're offering. So oftentimes in these kinds of situations, we're not horse trading down at 100 Center Street like we normally do. A lot of these cases will go to trial. If they pursue any of the charges, everyone that I talk to is not interested in accepting any plea bargains. So they better be ready for some trials if they're going to pursue these charges.
Are you finding that these people have other protests have dealt with? Characterize their level of commitment.
Oh, well, okay. I'm glad you asked because I'm a 47-year-old lawyer, Sam. And oftentimes I say to myself, man, you know, this generation of kids from 16 to 30, you know, they're useless. What do they stand? They don't stand for anything. I come down here, there's 1,000 kids in their 20s standing up for something. And you know what? My belief in this generation is improved today.
Yeah, and you know, our generation, we're from the same generation, not exactly the most stellar on that accord.
Well, quite true. This is the kind of thing that we've needed to see for the last 10 years. Why are our campuses so quiet?
Well, listen, I appreciate
you're
the work
very
you're
welcome.
Doing,
I like what you do very much. I'm going to go find you.
Je ne peux pas.